Our gospel reading, as you know, is taken from chapter 5 of Mark's gospel. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when he had stepped out of the boat, immediately a man out of the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. He lived among the tombs, and no one could restrain him anymore, even with a chain. For he had often been restrained with shackles and chains, but the chains he wrenched apart, and the shackles he broke into pieces. And no one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he always was howling and bruising himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and bowed down before him. And he shouted at the top of his voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" And he replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly to send him out of the country, not to send him out of the country. Now there on the hillside, a great herd of swine was feeding, and the unclean spirits begged him, "Send us into the swine, let us enter them." And so he gave them permission. And the unclean spirits came out and entered the swine, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and were drowned in the sea. The swineherds ran off and told it in the city and in the country. And then people came to see what it was that had happened. They came to Jesus and saw the demoniac sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, the very man who had had the legion. And they were afraid. Those who had seen what had happened to the demoniac and to the swine reported it. Then they began to beg Jesus to leave their neighborhood. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed by demons begged him that he might be with him. But Jesus refused and said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and what mercy he has shown you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone was amazed. The Gospel of the Lord. And so we have a wonderful story about a demoniac, somebody possessed by the devil. Who would like to speak first? Yes. Our leader. Fern is here.
This was most frustrating. 2 days I closed the Bible and walked away. Then I went back and read some other stuff. And I could finally sort of, all right, these are my thoughts. I'm not up to these things. All right. Whatever he was, the Legion. Is he trying to tell us that there's possibility of what could be, but he didn't know how to break free from it? Two faces of humanity, frustration and lonely. Fear God won't accept us. And then a hermit is a person who is rejected, overwhelmed by laws, and can't read my own writing. Overwhelmed by laws. Leave it at that.
Those are very good, Fern. Very good. Very good. Thank you.
I was actually looking for some answers in this, and it's not exactly the demonic thing, but we have a couple of issues at the store with customers. We have a homeless man living in his car in our parking lot, and we have had and have now someone clearly with mental problems who comes in every day who may or may not be homeless, and it's just very difficult to know how to deal with those people when you're in a public situation like that. And I was hoping there would be some kind of answer to that in this passage, but I'm not sure I saw that.
Wow, Gerasenes come right home, huh? Anybody else? Yes.
I think there's a little demon in everybody. And every morning when you wake up, you decide how you're going to use that day and what you're going to do. And when you look at life through your faith, you may have a much different approach to how you're going to spend that day than if you just go out and look and let the world dictate how you're going to be. And there's forgiveness for everyone. You just need to ask for it. I find it interesting, though, that when he asked to leave with Jesus, he said, no, you have to go back home. In a sense, you've made a mess, now you need to go clean it up.
I hadn't thought about that one. That's good.
My thought was that the demon wanted to rid himself of the demons, because when he saw Jesus, he went to Jesus. There are some people, sadly, as we know in this world, who aren't ready or don't want to get rid of their demons. But if we reach out, even if we're not perfect, and we are not perfect, but if we have hope that by reaching to Jesus that some of our demons will be relieved from us, then they will. But you have to want to run, or at least walk to Jesus in order to let that happen.
No, thank you. I thought it was difficult to see that, first of all, this group was banished and treated so poorly, and then I believe after being treated so poorly, then they did it to themselves. And it could have started by people accepting other people, regardless. And maybe it would not have grown to the point where it had come to. And I can understand why Jesus let him leave, and I mean let him stay, because he would be able to help everyone else understand what had happened and how to treat somebody other than what they had done to this group.
Well, both my thoughts have been taken, so I'm in a snit now. I read it several times at home, and I really had no clue. Absolutely, and it made me very frustrated. But driving to church today, I thought about it, and Greg's said or mentioned faith, and I said, well, maybe, you know, that's what it's all about, that we have to have a deeper faith. And then Nancy just alluded to the fact that what I was thinking, that if he went back home and why Jesus sent him back to where he was, that he could be a witness to what had happened and perhaps spread faith and belief with the people who had doubt.
Yes, Greg.
Is there a reason why they're swine and not sheep?
I think it's very confusing sometimes to know, and I'm talking about myself, you know, what is the Jesus in me and what is the demon in me? And how do you tell the difference? And how do you reconcile the two with your actions? It's, and I want to know why those pigs.
She feels bad for the pigs.
I know, I feel bad for the pigs. You're right. Is those pigs like a symbol of, you know, obviously they're a symbol. Symbol that, you know, we're gonna just send all this badness to this group and, you know, they're gonna run away and drown themselves, you know. I think it's a Jewish thing, right?
It is, it's a Jewish thing. Right. You're right. Anyone else? Yeah. I'm sorry? They gave themselves up. Okay. This, I hope you hear, it's possible, anything's possible. I hope you hear the depth of faith that, that you all have. I mean, it's just, was this shocking to you, Sam? It's very impressive. I don't know how many churches would be able to do what you do. Just some thoughts about the whole thing. First of all, there are always layers in the gospel story. And the layers we've talked about are obviously what was going on in Jesus' time, what perhaps he was addressing in terms of his discipleship, calling people to be disciples in the gospel, and ultimately what's the message about God, for God in this whole thing. And if you look at it from a sociological point of view, you have a society that was very, very comfortable, had grown very, very comfortable with the way things were. And that's a hard thing to say because this, remember, it was an occupied nation. They were being run by the Romans, remember? And as an occupied nation, they didn't have a whole lot of freedom. The one freedom that they relished, at least as far as the Jewish community was, they were allowed to have their own faith. And the Jews and the Romans lived side by side, and that was an accomplishment in itself. Because many places where Rome went into nations, they eliminated all the possible detraction and all the possible differences that might raise question about Rome's authority and their position in their town or in their state. So that being the case, there's some symbolism here, as I think you touched upon, Norma, some symbolism about Rome. Rome, remember, as an occupier, was hated by the people, obviously. Anybody that lives in occupation has a dislike for their situation because you have no rights. You have no power. You have no authority. You're given a little bit of room in which to breathe and to live every day, but it's all controlled. It's controlled by the state of the power. And the people disliked Rome very, very much. And Jesus, in this instance, uses something very close to people's hearts, that there were people among them, living among them, who really had distress in their lives. And those kind of illnesses, diseases that we may be able to label now as one thing or another, psychological or physical or something genetic. In those days, they didn't have that sophistication. So the question arose, as it did for you, what do you do when you find people like this? How are you supposed to bring your faith to that situation? It's interesting, in this story, the person is occupied by legion. Now, legion, the only word in Israel at the time about legion referred to the legions of Rome that were occupying their town, occupying their culture, in which they had no power. And so here you have a man who was possessed by legion being confronted by Jesus. And as an offshoot to the story, there happened to be a herd of swine over here. Now, it is a Jewish thing about the swine. They're not allowed to eat cloven-hoofed animals. Mostly swine. Okay, they're not allowed to eat that. That creates a problem for their relationship with God. And so they take that dietary rule very, very, very importantly in their lives. It's part of their living every day. And here, Jesus is taking Rome and casting Rome out of Israel. And when they requested to go into the swine, he said, oh, why not? And so they go, and they all run down the cliff, and they're all dead, which is an operational way of Jesus saying that the power that now controls you is not the power that needs to control you, because that power is temporary, and it will, in fact, die somewhere. Then he puts his attention on something else, the dialogue with this man. At the end of the story, he says, go back to your home, to your friends, and tell them what has happened to you. There's nothing that Jesus does in his ministry that doesn't somehow ask the person to reach beyond themselves and to begin to let that be known so people begin to understand where is God in your life. This man was totally possessed, and now he has found a freedom. And the freedom came because of a healing, a forgiveness, somehow an interruption or interception of that power that was there that overtook him, and he was restored to a place where he now had self-dignity, where he was now able to be a part of the community, and a real special part of the community because something happened to him that didn't happen to everybody else. And it was something, interestingly, that isolated him off into the boondocks by himself, not just the boondocks, in the graveyard. That's where he could live among death. The interesting thing here for me is that people in this situation, Rome, the people in town who were not a part of the scene till they come back in, and the demoniac had become very comfortable with their living arrangement. So comfortable, in fact, that everybody knew when they saw him that he was the crazy person. He was the one possessed by a demon and to be avoided at all costs. Rome allowed him to be there because they didn't know how to deal with him. And so they were happy he was living in the cemetery. And he himself was very comfortable, evidently, accepting his fate, if you will, his condition, and choosing to live among the tombs. And anytime somebody tried to bind him up, he'd break it so that he had at least that bit of respect, that bit of freedom in his own life, in spite of the circumstances in which he found himself. And for me, what this brings up is, in every situation in our lives, and you touched upon it, Greg, several of you have, in every situation in our lives, we always come at it from our own perspective. And if we come at it from a personal perspective, many times we find ourselves, it's between me and you. There's what we call that duality of thinking. That there's a relationship with me and you, and me and the world, and living in that dyad, I maintain my power because I hold you off at an arm's length at least, and have that place we call now on commercials, they call it private space, where you take a tic-tac before you talk to the person who somehow is approaching you in your private space so you don't offend. Interesting. This man was in his own private space. Rome was in its own private space, and the people in town were in their own private space. What happens when Jesus walks in? Is there no longer private space? It's not about private space, and it's not about being comfortable where you are in your personal private space. This is not about invading your private space. This is about recognizing that if, as Greg suggested, we begin our day and periodically throughout the day check in and say, who am I right now as a person of God? I recognize that I am an invitation to not keep people in their private space or in their walled-up lives or in their fears or in their dangerous lives in which they live. My role is to somehow bring hope to that moment, which is what Jesus did here. He says, in effect, that it is not okay to keep people in the boxes in which perhaps they were born. It is not okay to keep people perhaps in our memories that we can't let go of, that keep them somehow blocked into a lifestyle or a decision about who they are or what their lives are all about because of something that took place 15 or 20 or 40 years ago. It is not okay to pigeonhole people in any way, because when we pigeonhole someone or we label someone, we label whatever that is going to be, and that whole thing descends on that person, whether it belongs there or not. But in my judgment, I can make it belong to these people, and it may be a very dehumanizing, very undignified way for for them to live because of my choice. Which one of us can look back on our lives and find one spot where perhaps we would not want people to judge us on? One action, one moment, one experience, one thing for which we are somehow brought to our knees in humility and maybe in humiliation, were anyone to know about it or see it or hear about it, or that somebody accuses me of 45 years later and it ends up in the newspaper. And yet, it is very dangerously part of our human condition that we don't let go of some people's story. We don't let go of where they have been. We can't modify our appreciation of them because we continue to see them always through the very same set of eyes. We get comfortable with that kind of positioning. And having been in community lives my whole life, I can give you a million experiences and understandings and appreciations of that dynamic. A teacher who looks at a student the first day of school, and the kid is acting out because, let's say, it's boarding school like a seminary, and the kid is acting out because he's afraid or he's insecure, etc., and he gets labeled as somebody who doesn't fit. And for the rest of his time through the year, and maybe even the rest of his career, even long after that scene has been gone 30 years, he is still perceived in very much the same way because that person will not allow it to change. Or if somebody really desecrates one person's dignity with slander, with rumor, with somehow words that perhaps may not be my own, but words that certainly I know are powerful. You take the N-word in our culture, and we don't say it out loud anymore, and rightly so. But labeling somebody with the N-word back 40 years ago keeps that alive every time the word is spoken. And 250, 300 years later, that N-word still has a positioning relationship in our culture, where they are over here, we are over here, and ne'er the twain shall blend. But without even getting that far, it is very, very important that we as people understand that the world we are presently living in, with all of its dynamics and all the variations of religion and cultures and all the power plays and the national struggles and the international intrigue and the politics and all the things that clutter our newspaper and our minds, there has got to be a beginning somewhere where we find a way to deal with a person who comes into a store and who is seemingly out of touch with reality for whatever reason, or finds himself or herself living in a situation that most of us would find intolerable. We can no longer, I think, brothers and sisters, if we're serious about our faith, we can no longer close our eyes to what is beyond our ability to fix. We can't just eliminate something from our concern that we can't somehow personally get involved in or identify with, or something we don't understand. The world is becoming more and more and more complex. And it's becoming smaller and smaller and smaller in terms of the news making and the information and the media being able to make everything right in your face. And the sad part about it is you can't help but become somewhat paralyzed, at least spiritually, when you see it over and over and over again, and one horror as bad as the next and worse than the next one. It has to become, you have to desensitize in order to watch that. But that's what Jesus is bringing in this gospel story. A new sensitivity. A sensitivity that allows that I am able to give dignity to a person, even though it may not be appreciated by the world around me, even though it may not be the final fix, but in the moment of the encounter, I have the opportunity to give dignity to another person. And throughout my career of ministry and counseling and working with all the age groups and even those on the point of death, there is nothing more important than recognizing that in any moment, I may be called upon to redignify someone. I don't have to embrace their belief. I do not have to condone behavior. I don't have to enter into that person and try to manipulate it so it looks like everybody else. To embrace someone who is different restores dignity to that person. Maybe not enough to change his or her life, but all we have is the moment. St. Francis was known to have been, he was brought up kind of a snob. You know, Francis was son of a very wealthy merchant, fabric person. And obviously dealing with fine fabrics, he was in the parlor with the kings and the queens and all the nobles. And Francis had a problem with that because he saw poverty around him and he didn't know how to fix it. Francis saw within himself the desire to redignify those who had no dignity. And so he spent his life with the poor. But one day he came across the ultimate, a leper. A leper who not only did not have faith that he did, had not been acculturized as he had been because he happened to be a person in position, but he was able to recognize that here was a person who was out there on the fringes by circumstances, by faith definitions, by the powers of the society around him, and so you had that triad. And he stepped in, and for the first time in his life, he understood what it meant to give dignity where there was none. And when he put his arms around the leper, his whole perspective changed. And he could no longer go back in any way, not even to find support from the world around him, and he became a self-sufficient, live your life, live your faith, do as you believe, which was all about taking care of the poor. None of us are St. Francis. Maybe you are, but you're hiding it. But the truth is, we all meet people. We find ourselves in circumstances every day where a smile can make all the difference, where a kind word or a nice word instead of the usual look or glare or flip comment might hurt somebody. We have the option of making a difference. I think that's what Jesus is talking about. And you all are right on it because that's all you said. I thank you for this. Yesterday I had the opportunity at a funeral, at a graveside service of someone who was not connected here. Who lived to be in her 90s, and who was a person of great presence in terms of military, in terms of nursing, in terms of psychology, in terms of a lot of the things she did in her life. And it wasn't until the day of the service I learned that she was a gay person. And I had heard nothing but accolades and all kinds of wonderful things throughout the week from the people who are going to gather for this ceremony. And yesterday, standing there before the service began, I was talking to her sister-in-law. And her sister-in-law said, "Did you know that she was gay?" And I said, "You know, I didn't." She said, "The interesting thing is, all of us did, and it didn't make a whole lot of difference." In the light of what took place over the weekend, or Friday, it kind of rang bells. And that's why this, to me, is so very important. Not because of gays, but because there have been millions of opportunities in my life, and I'm sure in yours, where we have been called perhaps to give somebody a little bit of dignity, a little bit of respect, even if they don't smell good, or they don't look good, or they're shabby, or they're broken, or whatever their circumstance. That's all Jesus was doing. And that's the message from God. If there's anything in this gospel about God, it's not in the Romans, and it's not in the demoniac, and it's not even in the miracle, supposedly, of the exorcism, nor is it in the society in which the story is told. It's in Jesus walking in and doing the only thing he knew how to do. In his words, give them God. In our words, give him some dignity. In that, there's hope for today and tomorrow. Amen.